World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
The Allies have turned back sharp German counterattacks at several points along the western line today. The British have captured the French port of Calais. General Eisenhower's headquarters has just told the Austrians by radio to prepare for the arrival of the Allies. Russian infantry advancing on a 50-mile front in Yugoslavia is nearing one of the Germans' main supply railroads in the Balkans. In Italy, the British 8th Army has taken Savignano on the Bologna to Rimini Highway, and in South China, the Japanese have captured another important American airbase. Now for our first news direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to London. Larry Lesser reporting.
After one short taste of truce, the German garrison at Calais decided that peace was pretty wonderful after all. The 4,000 Germans entrenched at Calais surrendered to the Canadians after fighting for only 6 hours following yesterday's 24-hour truce to evacuate civilians. After 4.5 days of bitter fighting, the Battle of Calais ended in an anticlimax. On Friday, the Canadians reached the outskirts of the Channel port itself, and the Germans asked for a truce to evacuate civilians. The truce lasted from Friday noon until noon yesterday. Some 20,000 French civilians were moved out of besieged Calais to camps outside the town. Nearly all the German truck drivers who removed the civilians from Calais refused to go back and fight again. By the terms of the truce, they were allowed to return to the garrison if they wanted. Then the battle opened up again. Supported by a drenching bombing from British fighter bombers, the Canadian artillery went into action. Then, after all yesterday's trouble of moving out the French civilians, the Germans themselves collapsed, only 6 hours after the new battle began. Apparently, the Germans didn't have the heart to go on again after their brief taste of the pleasures of peace for 24 hours. Thus, the fall of Calais on the cliffs facing Dover leaves only one major strong point still holding out on the continental coastline facing England, historic Dunkirk, where 15,000 Germans are trapped. The fall of Calais brings the score of Germans taken prisoner in this futile defense of the ports to 82,000. Further south, there are still German garrisons holding out in the invasion ports of La Rochelle, Lorient, Nantes, Saint-Nazaire, and Bordeaux. Apparently, we don't need these ports, so we're willing to let them fall by their own weight. Latest news from these points say the French in these cities go about their business peacefully, while the Germans stay bottled up in their concrete fortifications, living on accumulated stores. The Germans themselves don't dare venture out on the streets because they fear the vengeance of the French forces of the interior. Up in Holland today, there was little movement on the ground or in the air. Cold, heavy drizzles kept infantry movement down to a minimum, and the bad weather kept the Air Force grounded. Down on the American Army front along the Siegfried Line, the same bad weather conditions prevail today, and only the soggy sound of artillery firing in the rain breaks the comparative lull. However, further south on General Patton's Third Army front, the Germans launched a heavy counterattack against the American positions near the little town of Jalaucourt, some 16 miles northeast of Nancy, which our troops beat back. The counterattack, but only after a battle which lasted between 3 and 4 hours. It's clear that the American 1st and 3rd Armies are now engaged in massive preparations to build up for another big push. While maintaining the initiative all along the 450-mile front, the Americans are poised to strike another concentrated blow. American shells whistle across the German frontier like flocks of wild geese. But behind the American lines, convoys of supplies are rolling in day and night. By truck and train from the captured French ports come the vast stores of material, all the way from the other end of our long supply line back in America. One of the newest sights along the roads to the German front is that of huge American trailer trucks, each carrying a brand new tank which has never seen battle before, tanks which will fight their first battles on German soil. The long run across France would cause too much wear on their tracks, so the American Army prefers to carry its tanks almost to the battlefield before they go ahead under their own power, when the great assault begins. And this is Larry Lesser returning you now to Admiral in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Big things are brewing in the great modern plants of Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. Post-war, there'll be a new, better record changer, so different in design, so simple in operation, that the old notion of record changer headaches will be completely wiped out. There'll be a revolutionary new electronic tone arm to give better reproduction to your favorite music. There'll be a new, faster changing time between records, less than 5 seconds. There'll be less wear on your records, less chance than ever of chipping or breaking them. Surface noises will be gone. Yes, indeed, if you want an automatic record changer after the war, you'll be wise to insist on an Admiral. Admiral is a leader in radio, radar, communications equipment, frequency modulation, and television. Due to its vast research program, Admiral's post-war line of radios will offer many more Admiral firsts. There'll be table and console models, portables, bantams, and farm sets. There'll be a wide variety of models of radio phonographs for the automatic record changers. There'll be FM, home recording, and television. In fact, there'll be everything for complete radio enjoyment in your after-victory Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Douglas Edwards.
A dispatch from Paris says French communists are not interested in political fighting for the time being, and their chief aim is to intensify the production of war material for the French army. Bernard Franchon, the general of the Communist Party and a leader in the General Confederation of Labor, told this to the United Press today. He said, "We definitely are set to remain faithful to the program traced by the French resistance during German occupation. The first and most important point is to continue the war against Germany until she is totally defeated." And now for a report on the bitter fighting going on in Italy, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
It is a cold, wet autumn on the Italian front. Our armies here, after crashing through the German siege line, have been stalled by rain and mud, and by an enemy who is still fighting desperately hard and still finding reinforcements to bring up into each threatened sector. Here in Rome, with the coming on of cold weather, Allied authorities are facing other problems. How to feed nearly 20 million Italians? How to get thousands of refugees back to their homes? How to tide this people through the winter? In Rome, there are still several thousand refugees living like horses in stables, in windowless, unheated, unlighted rooms in barracks about the city, sleeping on straw on the stone floor, with no blankets and scant clothing, only what they could take with them when they left their homes in places like Cassino and Formia months ago. Rome normally looks for her food to the Po Valley and the southern provinces. The Germans hold the Po, and insufficient transport has been made available to bring up needed supplies from the south. Many high American representatives here feel that our policy and our plans for Italy need to be clarified. All that our officials have to go on now is last week's Hyde Park Declaration. They are frankly puzzled by that statement. The pledge of greater responsibility for the Italian government might mean a greater degree of self-government, or it might merely mean that the Italians ought to do more to help themselves. The pledge of Italian representation in Washington and London might indicate the resumption of full diplomatic relations between Italy and the Allies. Or it might just mean that Italy will be allowed to send provisional representation to our capital. More technical experts are promised to help in Italian reconstruction. Officials here point out that we have a great many economic and industrial experts here already. What Italy needs is not more experts, but 2,000 trucks to help distribute food. The questions which Allied officials are asking now are these. How much shipping will be liberated to bring in what is needed to meet Italy's minimum food requirements? What transport will be made available in the country? What change will be made in the inter-regional rules which so far have badly hampered the distribution of supplies from one part of Italy to another? The Hyde Park Declaration has raised Italian hopes. Allied officials here feel that it will boomerang if it is not followed by concrete acts. And now back to Admiral in New York.
Nowhere in the world is the risky art of putting men and material on enemy shores better practiced than in the United States Coast Guard. For an interview with a veteran Coast Guardsman, here is Bill Slocum, Jr.
Lieutenant John Mitchell, United States Coast Guard, qualifies as a better-than-fair hand at landing operations. On 8 different occasions, from Kiska to Saipan, his help pour Marines, soldiers, ammunition, gasoline, and chocolate bars into enemy beaches. Lieutenant, tell us what a Coast Guard LST's job is in a landing operation.
Get the ship as close to shore as possible. Unload the men and material and get out. The last part is the best.
What would you say was your toughest landing?
It was something of a photo finish between Saipan and Tarawa. We were hit in a Saipan affair, so I suppose that was a little more unpleasant. A Jap shell landed right in our steering mechanism, and we couldn't control the ship.
That must have been fun.
Fortunately, we were skirting the island when we were hit, so the ship continued straight out to sea where a tug picked us up.
You've seen hundreds of Marines getting set for a landing. Tell us something about their reactions.
Well, there are no half-wits in the Marines, so nobody is very happy about it. But that Marine esprit de corps, or tradition, or whatever it is a wonderful thing. They are afraid of nothing, particularly Japs.
Speaking of those dandy little sons of heaven, did you see much of them on Saipan?
Oh, yes. I saw them jumping off cliffs, drowning themselves, blowing themselves up with hand grenades, and numerous other diverting tricks they do so well. I also saw some of their banzai charges, which are in no way diverting. They all get themselves killed, but a lot of Americans get hurt accommodating them.
Lieutenant Mitchell, in a somewhat childish indiscretion, went to work for a radio network, the name of which escapes me as completely today as it does on all other days. When, John, do you expect to return to your life of shame?
I don't know, Bill, although I've given a lot of thought to it. I do know, however, that we have the sheer, brute power to land anywhere and hold our positions. Admiral Nimitz and General MacArthur rarely call upon me for advice, of course. But I think it's pretty obvious we are Philippine-bound and China-bound. They'll both be tough, but I'm particularly anxious about that China thing. That may be a long, long battle. A lot of supplies will have to be carried a long, long way.
That, of course, is too true. But it's just as true that you, Lieutenant John Mitchell, and your Coast Guard mates will see to it that the men and materials get where they are needed, when they are needed, just as you have been doing since Pearl Harbor. Now back to Doug Edwards.
Our correspondent in Spain recently returned from a tour of southern France. For his observations and other news, Admiral takes you to CBS Madrid, Glenn Stadler reporting.
The city of Toulouse in France, which I and four other American correspondents visited 2 days ago, has created a paradox for itself by eliminating the black market. The new city fathers, while reestablishing legality in the distribution of food, also have caused considerable confusion because the new lawful system isn't as well organized yet as bootlegging was. The city of Toulouse in France, which I and four other American correspondents visited 2 days ago, has created a paradox for itself by eliminating the black market. The new city fathers, while reestablishing legality in the distribution of food, also have caused considerable confusion because the new lawful system isn't as well organized yet as bootlegging was. The result is that food appears to be more scarce than ever, apart from the fact that the Germans literally scraped the bottom of the barrel before they fled. Luxury items such as butter, which formerly went to the occupying Germans and the Frenchmen able to pay $30 a pound, now are spread out so thin they just don't reach very far. But Toulouse is so glad to get rid of the Nazis, the people are accepting this paradox in good heart and hope that by winter they'll have enough to keep everyone from getting too hungry. Foodstuffs destined for this region are beginning to arrive in limited quantities from the stock of about 12,000 tons of basic American products stored in Spain. More will come with improvement in transport facilities. In Toulouse, we had lunch in an average restaurant. There was only one menu of white beans, grilled tomatoes, and a bunch of grapes for the equivalent of $1 at the official rate. The former Black Market Deluxe restaurant had about the same thing to offer. Thus, the situation temporarily approaches perhaps one version of utopia, where rationing control is so strict that the rich and poor get equal amounts. Other towns in southwestern France haven't been so hasty about wiping out black markets before developing workable legal systems to replace them. Consequently, their better restaurants can offer a variety of delicacies. In Pau, we ate a 5-course lunch, including fish, chicken, meat, and champagne. It cost $20 each.
That was Glenn Stadler in Madrid. And now for a summary of developments in the Pacific, Admiral takes you after a brief pause to CBS Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
In the picture of world-shaking events, the little island of Peleliu in the Palau group does not loom very large. It is an oyster-shaped island, only about 6 miles long and 3 miles wide, flat and smooth on the southern end where the airfield is, with two peninsulas extending northward. On one of these peninsulas, the only bit of land on the island remaining to the Japs, United States troops are inching out the fight for the island in the face of Jap mortars and sawed-off naval guns in cave after cave, from which death is sprayed on the assaulting troops below. I've just returned from this island of Peleliu, and while this bit of land off there in the western Pacific is not very large in the picture of world events, it is a most important item in the campaign of the western Pacific, and therefore an important objective in our campaign against Japan. Peleliu contains a fine, large airfield, already in use by our planes. It dominates the entire group of Palau Islands, and thus controls a great area of ocean between the Marianas Islands and the Philippines. Our previous victories in the Gilberts, Marshalls, the Solomons, and New Guinea, in the Bismarcks, and the Marianas formed a large sack around a number of important Jap islands we once thought we'd have to take for ourselves. Islands such as Truk, Kusai, and Ponape. These and others are in this large sack, and Peleliu in the Palaus is the place where the string is being pulled tight around dozens of Jap strong points and possibly a quarter of a million Jap troops who have now lost their contact with their sources of supply and certainly must be written off entirely by the Jap High Command. Two things stand out in my mind after watching this battle for the Palau Islands. One is the problem of tremendous distances that our Pacific Fleet and amphibious forces must overcome in carrying the war to the Japs. For example, I traveled 6 days eastward by ship just to arrive at an airfield from which I caught a plane that carried me nearly 4,000 miles eastward here to the Hawaiian Islands, which is still 2,000 miles from the West Coast and 5,000 miles from New York. The second outstanding item is the way our Pacific forces are solving this problem of distance and throwing vast naval forces at the Japs right in their own front yard. We're traveling at will through the oceans of the Western Pacific. The seas leading up to the Philippine Islands are our seas, as has been so neatly demonstrated by the attacks of our carrier task forces. We have not one fleet, but several fleets, any one of which is ready and willing to take on what the Jap may turn up with. And yet, having just seen the stubborn way in which these strange little men dig themselves in and fight to the death, the manner in which the Jap command throws away lives by the thousands, and the dirty, wearying, bloody fight our Marines and soldiers must endure to kill these little men, it must be reported there's no quick and easy way to victory in the Western Pacific. It's going to take us quite a while, even after we get the transports and additional troops from the European theater. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
For an interview with a veteran LCT skipper who has participated in operations in the European war zone, Admiral takes you to Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
As Bill Slocum, Lieutenant John Mitchell, and Webley Edwards have hinted on this program, there's a new kind of warfare about to open up in the Pacific. We're almost through with the Coral Atolls. The South Pacific is almost ours. Nimitz and MacArthur are coiling their great machines to strike far into the Western Pacific, against the Philippines, China, and Japan itself. And except for the vast distances involved, which complicate the problem tremendously, this will call for a lot of the experience and know-how that has come from the invasions of North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and Normandy. That's what the Navy is preparing for. And here's one of the men who are getting ready for it. He's Lieutenant Junior Grade Jack Fuller, USNR of Columbia, South Carolina. At 23, a veteran of all the big European invasions, as skipper of an LCT, landing craft tank. Lieutenant Fuller has just come back from Normandy, where his ship was stopped cold by a German mine on D-Day, and where his men performed so well that he and the Navy, and a lot of the Army, too, are still talking about them. Jack, tell us about this new job you have.
Well, right now, I'm on temporary assignment. I'm training officers and crews and handling LSMs.
What is an LSM, Jack? That sounds like something new.
Well, Don, it is, comparatively. Although we have a lot of them already. It stands for Landing Ship Medium. Combines most of the best features of the LST. That's the biggest of the landing ships. The LCT and the LCR, the Landing Craft Infantry. and it has a lot of other advantages besides.
Like what, for instance?
Speed, for one thing. It's very fast. It can cover long distances. It can carry anything. And it's far more comfortable than any of the others. In fact, it has all of the accommodations that you'll find on a destroyer escort.
Well, when you get through with this training stint, what's your next move, Jack?
Well, I hope to get my own LSM eventually and take her out to the Pacific.
Well, you've been through a lot of landings already. What was the hottest?
Well, that's probably a toss-up between Salerno and Normandy. Salerno was the worst in some ways. We were there a lot longer, about 7 weeks.
Well, that was really rough, wasn't it?
Plenty. An awful lot of good men were killed there.
Well, but how about Normandy? Somehow I got the impression that the Normandy invasion went off pretty smoothly without very much trouble.
You should have been there. I guess it was smooth enough on the whole. We went into Omaha Beach. That was the deadliest thing I've ever seen. I ever hoped to see, for that matter. Before the day was over, the beach was covered with bodies. Dead bodies. Ruined tanks. An overturned landing craft.
Well, your LST was one of those wrecks, wasn't it? How did that happen?
Well, we had 4 big tanks on board and gone in pretty early, about 30 minutes before H-hour, to shell the beach with the tanks' big guns. Then we circled back out, dodging around a bit to get out of the fire from the shore. And finally, we went in to hit the beach. Just off the beach, about 100 yards, we hit a sandbar and stuck there. The water was fairly shallow beyond the sandbar, so we launched the tanks. But just as the last one got away, the stern swung around and hit a mine. She sank fast. So we had to evacuate. We had about 65 soldiers on board, in addition to my crew and executive officer.
Did they make it ashore okay?
Most of them. But we lost more than I like to admit. The Germans had the whole area covered with an awful crossfire. Everything from machine guns to the big stuff. The water was full of mines. We had to swim through all of that. But it would have been much worse if my executive officer, Ensign Mario Vasali of Los Angeles, and my bosun hadn't been so calm and capable. In fact, the whole crew was superb.
Well, offhand, it would seem to me that you and your men have done about enough. But we'll need your kind out the other way. And here's to you. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
For the latest news from the Russian front, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
A new southern front against Germany. A front which, in all probability, the Germans do not have the resources to defend, is rapidly taking shape. Russian troops are converging on Hungary from 3 sides. To the northeast, they are forcing their way through the Carpathian passes. To the southeast, they are reported by German and Hungarian sources to be deploying in great strength along a line between Szeged and Oradea. Though of this front, the Russian communiques have said nothing for several days. To the south, Russian troops have penetrated into that part of Yugoslavia which directly adjoins Hungary and affords an immediate threat to Budapest. There are various reports, none of them officially confirmed, that the Hungarians are seeking to make peace. These unconfirmed reports may very possibly be true, since Hungary lacks the resources to defend herself against the converging attacks of the mighty Soviet armies, and since it is hardly likely that Germany can now give Hungary effective help. These are circumstances of enormous significance, for if Hungary gets out of the war or is knocked out of it, the result will be that the Russian armies will come right up to the main entrance into Germany from the south, the Moravian gateway between the Bohemian Hills and the Carpathian Mountains. Here again is Doug Edwards.
And here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
In the peacetime days ahead, Admiral will present America's first complete refrigerator. The Admiral electric refrigerator will be complete because it will include all the features that the homemakers of America can desire to lighten their meal planning and cooking tasks. In the extra-large regular food compartment, you'll find pure, moist cold. Pure because of Sterilamp, whose ultraviolet ray action will kill bacteria before they have a chance to cause spoilage in your foods. Moist because the bulky, frost-collecting evaporator will be gone and therefore cannot draw the moisture from foods or from the air inside the refrigerator. And cold, say, in the built-in home freezer compartment for frozen foods, it'll be far below freezing, sufficiently cold to quick freeze your own foods or to store frozen foods for as long as you like. And don't forget, there'll be no regular, messy job of defrosting in the Admiral, America's first complete two-temperature refrigerator. Winter isn't far off, and fuel for home heating will again be scarce. So if you haven't arranged for your fuel supply, you should do so at once. Your heating equipment should be checked, and added fuel savings can be affected by heat sealing. Be wise. Prepare for winter now. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WBBM, Chicago. Conrad Nagel is your program host for the Radio Reader's Digest, heard tonight and every Sunday at 8 over WBBM. Tune in for outstanding drama and memorable bits of philosophy and humor. Time, 1:55.